Hi, I'm Jill Najeau, and I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller. Depression affects a lot of people, adults, teens, children, and those who love them. And we're talking about depression and its treatments with our guest today, Dr. Steve Garlow. He is a psychiatrist with UW Health Psychiatric Institute and Clinic and a faculty member in the Department of Psychiatry in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Do you think that you may be depressed? How did you help someone you care about get through depression? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Garlow.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, before we start talking about, you know, any of the new treatments that we have for depression, let's talk about what depression really is. What's the medical definition?
Yeah. So depression, and that's a really important question you ask, because the word is used sort of commonly in the language to mean a lot of different things, to mean I feel bad. I mean, people use that word to express some feeling of they don't feel good on the inside of some kind or another. As a psychiatrist, depression really speaks to a pathological mood state. It's not just a bad day. It's not just being sad. It's not just being upset over something that didn't go right in your life, or a stressful circumstance, or even the sadness over the death of a loved one. Those are all expected sadnesses. Those are all expected emotional responses. Depression is when a person gets locked into a pathological mood state that is, it feels in some ways like those sorts of things, a stressful circumstance or the loss of a loved one, but it lasts longer, has a deeper impact on the person's function. Impacts things like their sleep, their appetite, their activity level, their ability to participate in their life, puts them at risk for suicide. So it's more than just feeling bad. It is a pathological mood condition.
Well, and it seems like there's more and more people who have depression. Is it true, or is it just that people are throwing around that word? What's that all about?
Yeah, so that's a really great question also, and I really wish I knew the answer to it, because it seems that the use of the word depression or seeking treatment for depression has certainly expanded, is certainly much more common, as you say. I think it's probably a combination of a couple of things, and I think there, in general, this is a good thing, that there is much less of a stigma around seeking psychiatric treatment, seeking psychological treatment for mood conditions. And so I think people are much more open to talking about it, much more open to seeking treatment about it. Even if a person is feeling bad and it doesn't necessarily rise to the full diagnosis as I might give it, it's a good thing for them to feel empowered to go and seek treatment, to come to see a psychiatrist or come to see a psychologist or a therapist and seek treatment for it. So partly the other answer to your question is one of the sort of a fluctuating definition of the condition. The diagnosis, the formal diagnosis of depression, it's a definition in a book, but that's not based on, that's based on the opinions of smart doctors saying this is, in our opinion, this is what, this is the boundaries of what constitutes the disorder of depression. But it's not necessarily connected to a physical reality. Like blood pressure, you could measure blood pressure and say, well, here's the person's blood pressure. And above this level is too high.
Right.
But with depression, we're stuck with sort of what the person tells us and how it's expressed to us.
Very difficult to diagnose and treat, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Now, there's been a number of news stories in just the past few months about high-functioning depression. Now, what is that?
Well, I think that's referring to people who have otherwise been successful in their lives, and then are stricken with this condition. I mean, this is an episodic disease that comes and goes, and it doesn't necessarily respect socioeconomic lines or educational lines. And so, a physician, doctors can get depressed, lawyers can get depressed, executives, you know, important business people can get depressed. So I think, and again, I think that people are willing to sort of talk about it, I think that's a good thing because it's very much destigmatizing.
Right. So if people, so I, my understanding of this was that people in everyday life, to everybody, they seem really happy and they're functioning well, but privately, they're not.
They're pain very much on the inside. And sometimes people can do that. They can, you know, put on a good appearance while they are suffering in silence. And that's one of the, there's been a movement. There was a report came out last year from the Commission on Preventive Healthcare where they recommended screening everybody in sort of general healthcare settings for the presence of depression. And I think that's an opportunity to identify the person, how you just described them, who is putting on an appearance to the rest of the world that they're doing okay, but are suffering on the inside. If they're at a, they're just their family doctor appointment for some other reason, and they get screened for depression, that may be an opportunity for them then to seek out the treatment that they need.
And may feel a little, more comfortable.
People can put up, can have that appearance for a long time, and people around them will say, "Well, I never knew until something happens," or the person ends up dropping out of their job, or dropping out of their marriage, or dropping out of their life somehow, or worse, ends up dying from suicide. That's the other problem with depression. I can't look at a person. You can't look at a person. We can't and say, "Oh, well, that person there, he clearly has depression and needs treatment."
Right. Well, before we start taking some phone calls here, there has been some new developments on some treatments for depression. Let's talk a little bit about that. What do we see on the horizon?
Well, I think the one that has a lot of attention right now that's garnered a lot of press in the last couple of years, actually, is ketamine, which is initially came into the world as an anesthetic agent for doing surgical procedures in 1970. And then along the way, it was also discovered that it can be somewhat hallucinogenic, and it has a reputation as being used in as a club drug or as a recreational drug or as a hallucinogen. But in recent years, it's become very clear that ketamine also can, for some patients, be a very potent antidepressant in a way that other treatments have not benefited them. The interesting thing about ketamine compared to other antidepressants, other treatments, all other antidepressants starting back in the 1950s with the monoamine oxidase inhibitors through the tricyclics, through the SSRIs, they all work on the same basic set of neurotransmitters, serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine. Ketamine works through a completely different mechanism, completely different set of neurotransmitters, and potentially has a completely different mechanism of action. So I think there's a lot of excitement around it. There's a lot of limitations with it right now as a practical treatment compared to, say, being able to take it right now. It requires either an intravenous infusion or there are formulations that are essentially nasal sprays. They're more impractical than, say, having to just take a pill every morning. But I think there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of potential for it to be further developed as a treatment.
So do you think this would be a good option for those people who have tried the existing drugs and they just don't seem to do anything?
Yep. Oh, absolutely. And like I said, there are some inconveniences with it initially, but it's also a relatively, it's a relatively safe treatment. It's been, ketamine itself as an anesthetic agent has been in use since 1970. It's one of the most widely prescribed, most widely exposed to humans drugs there is, because it's used in all kinds of surgical procedures, in pediatric surgical procedures, and so there's a long track record with the safety of it.
And who can give this? I mean, can you give this to your patients, or do they have to do?
Before I moved here to UW, I had a large service at my previous institution. We're trying to establish one here right now. We have not yet begun treating patients here for various logistical reasons that we're trying to work out. But yes, I have previously myself treated a large number of patients with this.
So if someone right now is seeing a psychiatrist, they should discuss this with them?
It is a reasonable conversation to have. And there are providers. I'm not sure about, I just recently relocated to Madison area, so I don't really know who may be here, but at my previous institution, I had developed a very large service.
Okay.
We were treating a large number of patients.
Okay.
The drug companies are working on this as well. So there's a couple of sort of other approaches that are happening with ketamine. One is that other companies are trying to develop drugs that are sort of like ketamine, but not quite the same, that they may have the same antidepressant benefit. And the other avenue of development is with a nasal spray version of it that has some utility as an antidepressant as well. So instead of having to get an intravenous infusion, the person can essentially use this as a spray up the nose.
Well, great. That sounds like there's some really great things to look forward to.
Yep.
Let's go to the phones first. We've got Alicia here calling from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Alicia. Do you have a question for Dr. Garlow?
Thank you. Yes, I do. And thanks for taking my call. I am visiting my brother here in a rehab in Duluth. I have just had a consultation with a rounding psychiatrist who has suggested that Remeron might be a good medication for my brother, who does not seem to want to be responding to physical therapy after a fall and a fractured hip. And mm-hmm. I am trying to determine how one tells if a loved one is depressed with a traumatic brain injury and aphasia.
Yeah, that's a really great question. Both of the circumstances that you described, people with head injuries, people who've had strokes, people who've had various kinds of head injuries, have as a result of that, as a result of the damage to the brain, they develop symptoms that are, for all the world, appear to be depression. They may have come from a different pathway, but they are the patient experiences them as a depressive disorder. They can interfere with things like participation in physical therapy and rehabilitation activities, self-care, things like that. And so it's not an uncommon thing for a person who's had, say, a head injury or a stroke to be on an antidepressant as a way of helping to facilitate to have them feeling better, but also to help them facilitate their participation in their rehab and their rehab activities.
So is Remeron a good drug for this, do you think?
Well, Remeron is an antidepressant that is utilized oftentimes in, I can't speak to the specifics in this particular case, but it is used oftentimes in elderly patients, in medically ill patients. It has some potential advantages in those patients. Having depressive symptoms in a person who is medically ill can greatly complicate their ability to participate in their medical treatment. And so having a good psychiatrist involved and being able to really recognize the mood symptoms and coming up with the right treatment plan, I think, is that I would strongly encourage.
Okay, great. Thank you for your call, Alicia. Our guest today is Dr. Steve Garlow. He is a psychiatrist with UW Health Psychiatric Institute and Clinic and a faculty member at the Department of Psychiatry at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. What questions do you have about depression? Join our conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. We're talking about depression and its treatment. So let's go right back to the phones, and let's talk to Mike in Elkhart Lake. Hi, Mike. What question do you have?
Well, good morning. I'd like to suggest that the medical model of depression is only one of the models. I'd like to suggest that the psychosocial aspects of it are just as important. Number one, the people who you would think would be depressed. I visited Haiti and went to the poorest slum in Port-au-Prince. And if there's any group of people that should be depressed, it should be people who are in the situations like that. But they weren't. And it just dumbfounded me that depression isn't about medication. I think the simple answer is basically to realize that some of the greatest literature in the world was written by Lincoln when he was depressed. And art, for example, there's some great pieces of artwork that were when people were depressed. So I'd like to leave this with the Buddhists accept pain as inevitable. And the way that they would offset is basically that When it happens to you, don't fight it. Accept it and allow your body to heal, because there's something in the soul that may need to be expressed, and medications don't necessarily offer that. And I'd like to just give people a sense of when they're in the valley of darkness, do something for themselves each day that makes them feel better, but better yet, go out and do a random act of kindness if it's just opening up a door for somebody else, because it can kickstart the happy hormones that ultimately, I think, will lead to lesser depression.
Okay, well, thank you, Mike. Dr. Garlow, what's your opinion of that type of treatment?
Yeah, you know, the caller actually brings up a couple of really interesting, I think, important points. The one, when he talks about being in Haiti and you know, people who are in a really destitute situation and not having depression, that kind of gets back to what I was saying at the beginning. Depression's a major depressive disorder, as I utilize it, as I recognize it as a psychiatrist. It's a disease state. It is a malfunction of parts of the brain that manage mood and neurovegetative activities. Very much, I think, as a similar thing would be like thinking about the part of the brain that manages blood pressure is malfunctioning in people who have high blood pressure. And so it's not just the circumstances in which a person finds themselves. A person in the slum in Haiti finds himself in this very potentially destitute circumstance, but their brain is operating properly, regulating their mood appropriately, and they don't have the experience. The syndrome of melancholia has been recognized by many physicians going back thousands of years, and in all of the cardinal medical textbooks going back to ancient times all the way through the medieval times to the present, a syndrome of melancholia has been recognized. And that is a condition that comes from within. It doesn't come from without, and can be a very devastating form of depression that can render somebody homebound and bedbound and functionally, tremendously functionally impaired. That condition requires intensive medical treatment of some form or another. Now, the other point that the caller made was one of sort of psychosocial, non-pharmacological interventions for people, and I absolutely agree with that 100%. There are any number of different ways to approach depression. There are many that don't involve medications. There are a number of different psychotherapies that are sort of well-known, well-shown to treat depression. He mentioned taking a Buddhist approach and sort of a mindfulness approach, and there is evidence for the utility of those types of belief structures in managing the circumstances. And in some people, depression is a chronic disease. It converts from an episodic disease that responds to treatment to a more chronic condition. And in that case, taking more of a what we refer to as a recovery approach to it, that is trying to manage and advance one's life, even though they have a mental illness, even though they are experiencing the symptoms of a mental illness, that's the other aspect of it. And some of the things that the caller brought up, I think, are really key in taking on a recovery model, that to do something well and to do something good for themselves, and to, even though they may be feeling this depression, to make themselves take the next step. Those are all, I think those are all important aspects.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. And along that line, we've got Pat in Milwaukee. Hi, Pat.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'm following up on what Mike said and what the doctor just said. And my question is, why does it seem that in today's medicine, a pharmaceutical response is always the first response? In the case of depression, maybe changing brain chemistry would be facilitated by exercise or diet or music. Why is it always that we want to run to a drug first?
Dr. Garlow?
Well, that's, again, you ask a question that's really, I think, based, it's as much a manifestation of our culture. I could say the same, I could repeat the same question and switch in, instead of depression, high blood pressure, diabetes, elevated blood cholesterol, weight gain. There are many other chronic medical conditions that we have that we can manage through activity, diet, exercise, meditation, all these other things can be contributors to that. But people, when they when their doctor says, well, you have high blood pressure, you need to start exercising or take a blood pressure pill, we reach for the pill. That is kind of, I think it's in part an expression of who we are. Somebody comes to me and says, and they're coming to me because they're highly distressed. They are, and most likely some of the things that she suggested are no longer working for them. And at that point, then, if a patient comes to me with the symptoms of depression and the degree of functional impairment, I can recommend to them medication. I can recommend to them other kinds of treatments in addition to the activities that she listed.
Okay, thank you, Pat. Let's go to Madeline in Oneida. Hi, Madeline.
Hi, hello. I'm 75 years old, and in 1979, I was diagnosed with major clinical depression, and I was put on Elavil. And then over the years, I was transferred to other various medications. But anyway, in the late 1990s, the medication began to totally fail. And then in 2008, I heard a doctor speak on Wisconsin Public Radio about the importance of vitamin D. So I started taking 2,000 IUs of vitamin D every day. And within a month, I totally pulled out of it. And so now I don't take any pharmaceutical product. I take 3,000 vitamin D. And also, I heard, again, on Wisconsin Public Radio about some research that there is a brain-gut connection and that we should be taking a probiotic. So I started doing that. And also, citric magnesium, and make sure that you take your vitamin B12 by dissolving it under your tongue, and I am doing just fine now.
Well, that's wonderful, Madeline. And Dr. Garlow, are there other types of things that people can do in addition to the medications?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's really wonderful that she's feeling so much better. I certainly wouldn't disagree with any of the things that she's doing, and that they're clearly helpful to her. Certainly, having adequate nutrition, proper balance in the diet, proper balance of vitamins, physical activity. A couple of the callers have mentioned that doing things that the person feels are reaffirming to that individual, be it playing music or walking in the woods or whatever things, working in their garden, making sure that they stay involved in all those kinds of activities. I think all of those are important things. She did actually bring up an interesting point. I'd just like to make a brief comment on about this brain-gut connection. One of the things that is becoming more clear is that there is a relationship between the body's inflammatory response and inflammatory state and the person's mood state, and a lot of that is regulated, what's called the pro-inflammatory state, is regulated by what happens in the GI tract and what happens in the abdomen. And there is research around doing things to help understand and help then sort of modify inflammatory state as it relates to how the GI tract, the proper functioning of the GI tract, that will then lead to a lower pro-inflammatory state in the person and less likelihood of developing depressive symptoms.
Okay.
Well, I mean, that is one of this notion of sort of psychoneuroendocrinology is one of the places, is one of the growth points, is one of the points in research in depression where we're getting understanding more comprehensively of the whole body and how the physiology of the entire body kind of contributes to the person's mood state. It's a two-way street, the mood state contributing to the physical body, the physical body contributing to the mood state.
Always know more. Yep. I was going to follow up with one of the things she was talking about. Now, she's been taking medication for quite some time. Has there been a big change in how medication is given or what types of medication? So if someone who's listening who maybe took it 20 years ago and had a terrible reaction. Is it something they should revisit?
Yeah, so the medications have certainly evolved over the years. The first generation of antidepressants were monoamine oxidase inhibitors, came out in the 50s. Difficult medications to take, a lot of side effects, the dietary restrictions, dangerous in overdose. They were then passed by with the tricyclic antidepressants, which are more effective but also difficult. They can have a lot of side effects, dry mouth and sedation and other sorts of things, and also dangerous in overdose. Then in the 90s, I guess in the late 80s, the SSRIs, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, came out, medicines like Prozac and Zoloft and Paxil. And those medications are certainly safer. They're much safer to take. They have much lower side effect burden. And there's been sort of more medications like that since. So the medications have clearly evolved over time. And they are certainly more tolerable and easier to take, safer. One of the interesting things, though, is they still all basically operate through the same pathways, as opposed to a medication like I mentioned earlier, like ketamine, that operates through a very different pathway. But I think certainly medications now, especially if the person last tried, she had mentioned Elavil, that's a tricyclic antidepressant, that they are there are a large number of safe and effective medications available right now.
Okay, so check with your doctor. Let's go to Jack in Eau Claire. He's been waiting a little bit. Hi, Jack. What's your question?
Hi there. We have a son who has been struggling with depression for at least 10 years, probably a little longer, and all of the suggestions that everybody has are fine and everything, but sometimes they don't work, or there are pretty severe episodes that debilitate him greatly. And the frustration that we have is that he's not suicidal, and so there is no in-house programming, nothing for him unless he declares that he's suicidal. Depression is not something that agencies, hospitals, programs, whatever, want to deal with unless there's a suicidal aspect to it. And so when he's having these debilitating times, he'll even go to the ER looking for something in case the meds are screwing up or something. But and they just send him home and say, be happy, you know. Do some push-ups or something like that. And there's no in-house program. He needs to really, and it's created a lot of job loss, which re-triggers even more depressive episodes.
What are his options, Dr. Garlow?
Well, yeah, no, so this caller brings up what I think is a really important point from a public health perspective and a patient and a family perspective, and that's the availability of mental health treatment and availability of good psychiatric and psychological treatment, and who will pay for it. It becomes an issue in part that third-party payers dictate what services are available. And so the point he brought up about being in the hospital only if the person declares suicidality, that comes from criteria from insurance companies, essentially, who will say, well, we'll pay for the hospitalization because the person is suicidal, but if they're not that, if they don't have that degree, we won't pay for it. And so the payer structure has greatly impacted how services are available. And there's frankly, this is, I guess, my opinion, it's not the same in terms of what's available for patients with mental illness, what treatments are available for patients with mental illness versus what's available for people with cardiac problems or other kinds of problems, which are there are sort of more resources available. The third-party payers pay more for rehabilitation activities. Not to say that those aren't important in those other diseases. It's that I think this is part of there's an enduring stigma, an enduring institutional stigma around mental illness and the treatments that are available for it. And unfortunately, there, and this is in Wisconsin, this is a state that is underserved in terms of the total number of providers, of mental health providers and available mental health resources. The solutions, though, are, you know, they're political, they're social, they're economic, all those things come to bear. But I personally think this is a manifestation of still of the enduring stigma against mental illness and making treatment more widely available.
Okay, well, good luck to you and to your son, Jack. Our guest today is Dr. Steve Garlow. He's a psychiatrist with the UW Health Psychiatric Institute and Clinic and a faculty member in the Department of Psychiatry at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And we do have one open phone line if someone wants to still call in. I'm going to go to email. One of our listeners, Jean, emailed that she would like you to talk about depression and treatment in children. She said, as a teacher, she can see students in her classroom that are suffering with so many situations, and they would like to know how can they recognize potential problems. And also, as you had mentioned, the treatment in the northern part of the state is really, you know, not a lot of it there. So what can you do to help her?
This is another great question. Depression. So one of the other things that we've come to understand about depression now, a more modern understanding of it is a lifelong disease, and we can see very often the beginnings of it back in childhood or in adolescence, and sort of it comes in waves as the person gets older, and there'll be some manifestations of it maybe in childhood or adolescence, and then more severe manifestations in their 20s or their 30s. In children, the problem is changes in behavior can be caused by a lot of different things, and so depression doesn't come out looking the same in a child or an adolescent as it does in an adult. It doesn't come out looking with the same kind of melancholic features, and it can be the person becomes more withdrawn, more inactive, but it also can come out as the child becomes more problematic and has behavioral issues or anxiety issues or sleep disturbance kinds of issues. But there are treatments that are available to children and adolescents as well. But this is where having a really well-trained child psychiatrist or child psychologist really comes in, is a critical aspect of this, to really come up with a good understanding of what's going wrong with the child or the adolescent. And to the point you made again, and Wisconsin is underserved with psychiatry, and it's greatly underserved with child psychiatry, as is the whole country. Those are going to be, it's going to be the availability of having a good clinician who really understands the depression in children and adolescents is the first step.
And is there some place that they can go online, since there's not a lot of doctors up in her area?
Yeah, the bigger the city, the more providers there are.
Sure.
Here in Madison, we have the medical school, we have the Department of Psychiatry here, we have child psychiatry program here. Over in Milwaukee, with the medical school over there, there's child psychiatrists over there. Chicago will have even more, there's a gradient from big cities to small towns to the country in terms of all, not just child psychiatrists or psychiatrists, but sort of all medical specialists. There are more in the big cities than there are out in the country.
So maybe she can reach out to those areas and see if they have any tools.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yep. Let's go to Anne in Madison. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to quickly explain what I feel right now. I have a really strong social phobia. I definitely sabotage relationships that people that get close to me. I cry all the time. I am bipolar. I don't like going out when it's a sunny day because people can see me. I think they're talking about me or trying to go against me. I don't like going to stores unless I'm holding my small dog or I'm finding a reason for being there, like pushing a grocery cart. Just stuff like that. I have no problem sleeping because now I've turned to a strong rum drink, and I don't even feel comfortable around my kids.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Ann. Dr. Garlo, what can Ann do?
This is a complicated issue. I hope she's seeing a psychiatrist. I hope she's involved with a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist of some kind.
Are you seeing somebody, Ann? Ann, are you seeing someone?
No, I'm too scared to get close to anybody. I sabotage that, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the first step here is to find a psychiatrist or a psychologist with whom you can have a comfortable relationship. I know it can be difficult, but you have to balance the distress you're having with the possibility of feeling better and overcoming the temporary hurdle of the social anxiety. But when you're having this much distress, going to see a psychiatrist, going to see a psychologist, a competent psychiatrist or psychologist, is really going to be the first step. Maybe if you had a friend or a family member, a spiritual advisor or somebody like that in whom you trusted, could be an aid in getting you there, could help you overcome that hurdle.
Is there maybe an 800 number that she can call that at least she wouldn't have to leave her house for?
Yeah, I this is something that has to be done in
okay.
person. The problem with things like, you know, national hotlines and 800 numbers is it'll be a general assessment, and it'll have to be seen in person to manage this.
Okay. Well, Ann, we wish you the best of luck and hope you have the strength to go out and get help for yourself. We have been talking with Dr. Steve Garlo, and I want to thank him very much for joining us today. We appreciate your time, Dr. Garlo, and hope that you can come back again. Obviously, we have lots of questions from lots of listeners.
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you. Coming up next, we're going to talk about antiques and collectibles, switching topics quite drastically here. So I hope you can stay with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.